A new way to explore the solar system, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Cost and lack of experience have generally put planetary science missions out of reach for all but the wealthiest nations and space agencies. That's changing. And we'll learn today about a new effort that promises to accelerate this change, putting participation in missions within reach of universities and other institutions around the world. Two founders of the Milo Institute, planetary scientist Jim Bell and space entrepreneur Lon Levin, will be my guests. Earth has a newly discovered sister, just 100 light years distant. We'll hear about this world from Emily Lakdawalla in moments, and we'll wrap this week's show with your jokes about space and the new year as Bruce Betts guides us through what's up. Did you know that I write a monthly Planetary Radio newsletter? I have a lot of fun with it, taking readers behind the scenes of the show, and it has become one of the Planetary Society's most popular mailings. The next edition comes out on Friday, January 24. You can sign up at planetary.org/radio. Here's a sampling of space headlines from the latest edition of The Downlink, the Planetary Society's weekly digest presented by our editorial director, Jason Davis. The first ever core stage of NASA's giant space launch system rocket is ready for shipping by barge from Louisiana to Mississippi, where it will be installed in a giant test stand and fired before heading to Florida. If all goes well, the first test flight will send an uncrewed Orion spacecraft to lunar orbit in 2021. The European Space Agency's Rosalind Franklin Mars rover recently underwent electromagnetic interference testing ahead of its scheduled mid-2020 launch. Whether or not the rover will be able to leave Earth this summer depends on crucial parachute testing. If successful, the rover will join Mars missions from the U.S., China, and the United Arab Emirates. And here's one you have to see. Astronauts aboard the International Space Station watched from above as the Quadrantids meteor shower, always a tough one to say, rained down on Earth. An image shows several meteors streaking through the atmosphere with the northern lights in the background. There's a link in the January 10 edition of The Downlink that's easily found at planetary.org/downlink. That edition also has a story about the discovery of an intriguing exoplanet. As I said, I invited Planetary Society Solar System Specialist Emily Lakdawalla to tell us about it. Emily, the discoveries from TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, are rolling in, and the latest, of course, is the latest discovery of a planet that may not be too different from our own. Can we talk about TOI-700D?
Yeah, it's amazing how commonplace the discoveries of new planets have become. It's just one of the most wonderful things about the 21st century. And this is a planet, like many, that are in the habitable zone of its star, which I should define briefly. It's the space around a star in the planetary system around a star in which it's close enough to the star for water not to be solid all the time, but far enough from the star where water won't be gas. So it's basically what people call the Goldilocks zone. It's an area around the star where water could theoretically exist. And an interesting thing I want to point out about habitable zones that I think not everybody realizes is that they don't stay static. They don't stay in the same positions with respect to a star over time, because a star changes in brightness and heat output over time. And so these things actually move over billions of years as the star evolves.
You surprised a bunch of us at the Planetary Society yesterday because, like them, I believed that, okay, Earth, we are the most Earth-like planet. And therefore, we must be right in the middle of the habitable zone. Apparently not so much.
Yes, this is one of the great many reasons why I do not like the phrase Earth-like planet to describe what we're really looking for in other solar systems. Because after all, Earth, we know as the place that is our home, that is covered with liquid water oceans, that has been the habitat for life for 3.8 billion years. But it's actually not in the very dead center of the habitable zone. It's actually quite a lot closer to the inner edge of our sun's habitable zone than the outer edge. Venus is not within the habitable zone, but Mars is. So the sun gets a little bit hotter, or Earth gets a little bit warmer, and it'll not be all that habitable anymore. Now, I do want to calm people's fears. It's not so close to the edge of habitability that the global warming that we should rightly be worried about right now is enough to tip us over into non-habitability. Earth has, in fact, warmed before, just not this fast. And so, you know, life will still exist here. It just may not be so fun for us.
Well, that's reassuring. We'll leave that role in our own solar system to Venus, I suppose. Emily, thanks very much for making this world that is just 100 light years away so much more accessible.
Thank you, Matt.
That's Emily Lakdawalla. She is our solar system specialist, not just this solar system, but the solar systems that we're discovering all over the Milky Way galaxy. And she'll continue to join us from time to time here on the show. Professor Jim Bell of Arizona State University is no stranger to planetary radio. The famed planetary scientist and author was back at Planetary Society headquarters in early December for a meeting of the Society's board of directors. Jim is principal investigator for the MASCAM-Z cameras that will leave for Mars this summer as part of the Mars 2020 rover. Joining him at the board meeting was space entrepreneur Lon Levin. Lon was a founder of what is now the SiriusXM Satellite Radio Network. He currently serves as president and CEO of GeoShare, an independently managed but wholly owned subsidiary of Lockheed Martin. I had learned not long before the meeting that Jim and Lon were among the founders of the nonprofit Milo Institute, where Jim is chief scientist. I asked them to join me in the Society's media studio for a conversation about this new organization that wants to make exploration of our solar system accessible to universities and even nations that could only dream of such involvement till now. Full disclosure, Jim is president of the Planetary Society board, while Lon is the treasurer. If you catch my full interview with them in our podcast, you'll hear me say that talking with them about the Milo Institute was entirely my idea. I think you'll understand why I thought this was so important and exciting very soon. Here's the slogan, or your raison d'etre, I guess: transforming space science through shared cost and global collaboration. What's the sort of elevator speech, the pitch that describes the Milo Institute?
No, let me try mine first, Lon, and you can go second. But
go ahead.
So the Milo Space Science Institute is a nonprofit that is associated with Arizona State University, and it's designed to test the hypothesis that you can build a consortium of members, institutions, universities, countries, national space agencies that together, using combined resources, knowledge, skills, together can do deep space missions to achieve exceptional science. That's really what Milo is all about.
Well, it did start at TPS because, as you observe,
The Planetary Society.
Yeah. I've been on the board for a while, so has Jim. I came to really admire, I am not a scientist. I'm more of an entrepreneur in space, but I came to really admire two things about all the great scientists and the great minds that I was working with on the board. And that is that, one, they think about grand ideas, they implement amazing ideas. The science that they know with their great minds is just so impressive. That's the one thing that they did so well. The second thing that they did so amazingly well is whine about how little money they had from NASA and every freaking board meeting.
We're not whining, Ron.
Was amazing to me. And I said, there's got to be something better. Now, I'm thinking more on the business side of this. How do we fix this? The good news is that Jim invites me to go talk to the ASU students once a year and all that. And he says, I want you to meet Michael Crow. Now, Michael Crow, who is the head of Arizona State University, one of the most brilliant academics in the United States, if not the world. And what was to be a 20-minute meeting ended up being an hour and a half. Why do we have to keep on doing great space science? There's one way, which is the government gets the taxpayer money, and the big one is NASA, ESA does it too, JAXA, whatever. They all follow the same model. Why does it have to be that way? Can't we essentially do it without the government help? and work together collaboratively. Now, we're not talking about building a multi-zillion dollar Hubble, but the idea was, is there a compelling space science that can be done? Mm. What at some more affordable level? And in our minds, it's $200 million or less that can be spread out among many, many people in the world. And that's the idea. So what we're chasing is there's more compelling space science that needs to get done that's getting done. Two, all these space agencies throughout the world, there's a proliferation of them throughout the world. There's maybe at this point 40 or 50 of them.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because every country now that has any kind of wherewithal is saying this is going to help our economy. And so we're taking advantage of the compelling space science that needs to get done, all these countries that are interested in space, and three, everyone wants to educate their kids. So the Milo Institute, we have three principles and what we're doing and what we're chasing. The three of us said, let's see if we can do something different. And here we are now, 2 years later, doing what we're doing. Three principles. It's got to be compelling science. Jim Bell and his team, but it's Jim who says this is compelling science.
Knows how to do compelling science.
Yes, but it's got to be compelling science. There's a lot of people chasing great engineering in space. Engineering gets us the great science. The second thing is it's got to be affordable. In our minds, $200 million or less. Actually, our first mission's a lot less. We'll talk about the lunar lander. And then the third part of this is it's got to be timely. We've got to do something that people will take note of quickly. And what that comes down to is within 5 years, we can do a mission. We think that's how long it takes to get a PhD, whatever. And so it's got to be the neighborhood. It's got to be Mars, Venus, asteroids, the moon. That's where we're concentrating right now. We hope for greater things in the future, but that's what we're doing right now.
The reason for the whining, my friend Lon, is that, and I think your listeners know this, so many missions for planetary exploration are proposed to NASA, to the Europeans, to the Japanese, the Russians, Koreans, other space agencies, and many space agencies around the world. And at least for NASA, for example, something like 9 out of 10 missions that are proposed are rejected.
And yet so many of them, almost basically all of them,
they're all spectacular missions, yeah. Absolutely. And so there's clearly plenty of space science, planetary science that we can be doing. As someone who's both won and lost those mission competitions, you know, I know that the competition is fierce, and NASA really likes what we're trying to do because they know that there is so much more to do than they are able to do, just like the Europeans are not able to do everything as well. So, and secondly, coming back to this dozens of space agencies around the world now, it's very difficult, especially for new players in the space game, countries or institutions that are trying to get in there, work their economy, recognize what Lon said, space is part of a modern world's economy. We've spoken to a lot of them. We've met with a lot of them in their countries and at international conferences. They get frustrated because they can propose to be involved in a NASA mission or an ESA mission or others, but they don't have any experience. They have lots of interest, enthusiasm. They may have an industrial and academic base that supports their involvement. But because they don't have the experience, NASA being conservative, the European Space Agency being conservative, says, no, we're going to pick the folks that we know.
It's
or the
catch
folks
22.
That, right. So we come along and we'll talk about more about this. You know what? You don't have to compete. This is a member organization. What you have to do is join.
I'll be back with much more from Jim Bell and Lon Levin of the Milo Institute. This is Planetary Radio.
The Planetary Society is building the ultimate list of life goals for space fans, and we need your help. Hi, I'm Kate Howells, Community Engagement Leader for the Society. What's on your list? The must-see objects in the night sky, the most awe-inspiring destinations, the experiences of a lifetime. Tell us about them at planetary.org/space goals. We'll share them with your space soulmates around the world. That's planetary.org/space goals. Thanks.
I know you're a fan of space because you're listening to Planetary Radio right now. But if you want to take that extra step to be not just a fan, but an advocate, I hope you'll join me, Casey Dreyer, the chief advocate here at the Planetary Society, at our annual Day of Action this February 9th and 10th in Washington, D.C. That's when members from across the country come to D.C. and meet with members of Congress face-to-face and advocate for space. To learn more, go to planetary.org/dayofaction.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. My guests are Jim Bell and Lon Levin, two founders of the new Milo Institute, based at Arizona State University. After I'd heard some of the Institute's hows and whys, I wanted to know about their big plans for missions around the inner solar system.
One option that we studied was just a, am I allowed to say kick-ass on radio? It was a kick-ass, Venus mission, and it was spectacular. We couldn't get it into the price point. We should try to do this mission someday.
It's right? on the list. We're going to do it.
Because it was a Venus mission, we were, you know, Venus to Milo. We were kind of codenaming it Milo. It was a secret project we were doing, you know, codename Milo.
This is the most important question I had for you in this entire conversation.
Where's it come
Where did
from?
Milo,
Where
come
Milo
come from?
From right? And Lon's idea was to keep it all caps so it kind of looks like an acronym, but it's not.
It's not.
Confuses people. They get talking about it. They ask this question.
Actually, we'll go back to what you were saying because it's important, more important, but I want to make a very important point about Milo, and that is it is not an acronym, and no one's going to make it an acronym. We are different than every other organization in space. This is not an acronym. It's a great name. I'm done.
Because we could go to our listeners and have a contest and make it into an acronym.
We've tried. We've got lots of big lists.
Yes. We have a big list of this. It's not going to get acronymized.
Okay.
Is that what it's called?
Acronymized.
Okay.
Anyway, so we had this set of missions, and the one that rose to the top, and again, this is going back to 2018, is NeoShare, which is a single launch of a moderate, medium-class launch vehicle that's carrying six small satellites. They could be CubeSats. They could be small sats. Six satellites that are independent spacecraft that are all launched from a deployment ring off of that one launch vehicle, each of them sent on a trajectory to encounter, just as a flyby, at least one near-Earth asteroid. Some of the spacecraft, because they carry their own propulsion system, some of them could be diverted onto a second. Because it turns out, and this was what our friends at Lockheed on the mission architecture side discovered for us, it turns out any day you want to launch, tomorrow, next week, 3 years from now, any day, with a medium-sized launch vehicle and the Delta V capability on one of these typical small sats, any day there's 100 near-Earth asteroids you could fly past and about 20 comets you could fly past that aren't too far from the Earth.
Says something about the threat that
there's
they present.
There's 20,000 known objects out there, right? Yeah. So any day. And we have only visited five with spacecraft. In one Milo mission with six spacecraft, we think we can get 8 to maybe as many as 10, but maybe at least 8 flybys, almost double the number of spacecraft flybys in a single mission.
That's right? The compelling science.
Right. And then what we discovered, you know, over the course of a year, people are interested in that, but the price point is it's daunting. Right. It's even
as,
a couple
well
hundred
as
million
Milo Institute has not proved itself.
That's right.
As a model.
That's right. So we came up with two smaller versions. I'll talk about one and then you can talk about the other. How about that?
Can you talk about both of them?
The smaller version.
I'll have the color commentary.
All right. You have, the first one is a subset of NeoShare. We asked ourselves, if we were to only send one or two satellites instead of six, of course, we could bring the cost down dramatically. We wouldn't need a dedicated launch vehicle. We could do a rideshare, for example. But is there a compelling single near-Earth asteroid, we wouldn't be sampling diversity anymore, right? Could you just go to one object? And my bar for science is really high. And, you know, sampling diversity of 10 objects, wow, that's spectacular. But just go fly by one near-Earth asteroid. Science Council, we thought about it. And the answer is yes. There is, in fact, one and perhaps only one super interesting object that is worthy of a dedicated low-cost flyby mission, and that's Apophis. And
which,
you know about
which
Apophis.
Which has been mentioned many times
you know about Apophis.
On this show.
On April 13th, 2029, which is a Friday, by the way, on April 13th, 2029, the asteroid Apophis, which is 4 or 5 football fields in size, will fly very close past the Earth within about 5 radii of the center of the Earth. Well within the orbit of the moon. It'll actually fly past fairly close to the moon as well. But well within the geostationary satellite ring where Lon's spectacular XM satellite ring is located. This is a really close pass. It won't hit the Earth, but it's going to come really close. It'll be a naked eye object over the Atlantic that night. 7 or 8 years later, it's going to come back by the Earth. And this object, this particular one, always comes back close by the Earth. It's not known. Astronomers don't think it's going to hit the Earth anytime soon. But we don't know 10,000 years from now, a million years from now. You know, every time it passes by the Earth, it tweaks its orbit just a little bit. So what we want to do is take a subset of NeoShare, a couple of these satellites, and just fly by Apophis well before the 29 flyby. Mm. Our expectation is that NASA, the Europeans, Japanese, others are going to be mounting some significant mission efforts to study Apophis, because this is not only a great science opportunity, but a great planetary defense opportunity. And of course, Planetary Society members know all about planetary defense. It's one of our big staple columns upon which we rest.
Just trying to save the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So a big planetary defense implication, big science implication. And we expect that the world's big space agencies will be doing a lot of stuff in 29. So we want to go. Apophis comes by the Earth every couple of years. There are opportunities in 23, 24, 25, 26. We just want to do a quick little reconnaissance, relatively low cost. Imaging, spectroscopy, geology, composition, basic properties, mass, density, if we can measure them, and feed that information forward into the big space agency's billion-dollar class missions so they are ready, so they are optimized. And that has gotten a lot of interest and a lot of attention because the price point there is closer to $50 million. Right. So that's one. And the second one is really just a fabulous opportunity because Lockheed is one of the commercial lunar payload service CLPS providers for NASA. Mm-hmm. So they're building a spectacular lunar lander, the McCandless lunar lander, that is has a lot of heritage from their Mars lander experience, Phoenix and InSight. So they're leveraging that technology to go to the moon, and they're making available some payload space for Milo members at a great price, $1.3 million per kilogram.
Yeah, that is a deal.
And so there's an opportunity now for Milo members, and it could be a single member. It could be a small consortium of members who want to occupy a certain amount of payload volume, power, mass, data volume, et cetera, to go to the moon just in the next few years.
Thank you, gentlemen. Lon, Jim. Exciting stuff throughout. I wish you the best of luck with the Milo Institute.
Great to be here, Matt. Planetary Radio rocks.
That's right. It's wonderful. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you, guys. I'll let you get to lunch.
Yeah, thanks.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. It's the joke edition of Planetary Radio. We're laughing already. That laugh that you just heard came from Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who's back to tell us about the night sky. And he's the one who posed this question that resulted in some good stuff, some good humor from a few of you. Not very many of you, but a few of you. Welcome.
One of these stranger trivia questions I've asked. As I looked back at it, but people rose to the challenge. How about I tell you what's up, Matt? Actually, you know, I'd like to mention something else first, which is I want to make sure people know there's a LightSail 2 update blog from last week by Jason Davis that reports on a technical paper presentation that was given by a Purdue graduate student, Justin Mansell. We explain a lot of the orbital evolution and why the perigee and apogee go up and down, and there's even some pretty pictures thrown in for fun. So check it out at planetary.org or sail.planetary.org.
That qualifies as a What's Up item, but what else is out there?
Venus just dominating the evening sky. It's spectacular in its spectacular brightness over in the west in the early evening. And then in the morning, we've got Mars still hanging out near the reddish star Antares and Scorpius, making a lovely red-red combination. Scorpius Antares is to the right of Mars. The two of them will be hanging out with the crescent moon on the 20th, which will make a lovely sight in the pre-dawn east. That's where you're looking. And then Jupiter is rising into the lower left of Mars, coming up in the pre-dawn east. We move on to This Week in Space History. And Matt, after I believe last week's show, you'll be excited to know that in 1747, Johann Bode was born.
That's interesting. That it's a nice coincidence that he came up so soon after he made it into the show.
Yeah, after so Bode's law, which turned out to not really be a law, but basically says that each planet is twice as far as the last planet from the sun, roughly, and it works pretty well until you get to Neptune and then all the other objects, and then it kind of doesn't. But he also was instrumental in his prediction of where people looked for Uranus and finding some old observations of Uranus that we will talk about. Hmm. Also, 2006 was a big week. Stardust returned with samples from a comet, and New Horizons was launched off towards Pluto and beyond. We move on to random space fact. Almost 100 years before Uranus's discovery by William Herschel in 1781, John Flamsteed observed it at least 6 times, but didn't recognize it as a planet. But we go farther back, there's possible observations of Uranus by Hipparchus in 128 BC. And then in 1750 and 1769, the French astronomer Pierre-Charles Le Monnier observed it at least 12 times, but it just was moving so slowly, all these people thought it was a star.
What a shame that it didn't work out for Flamsteed, is it, I think?
We'll come back to Flamsteed, amazingly enough. But first, our serious, serious joke competition. So I challenged you to create a joke that combined space and New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, or the New Year in general in some type of way. Any kind of joke or humorous riddle would be accepted, had to be clean. How'd we do? Well, I know how we did, Matt. We did. It was a challenge for people, but people, I thank you for giving such effort to my mind's weird wandering.
We don't, of course, have time to read all of these, but I will add my thanks to all of you who took on this challenge. And here is that winner from Mel Powell. The biggest problem with Universal New Year is that I keep forgetting to write 13.8 billion and one on my checks. You still write checks, Mel?
That's true. We just accepted that without a second thought.
I wrote one today. So congratulations, Mel. You have won that set of 3 Planetary Society stickers from chopshopstore.com, which is where you'll find the Planetary Society store. And it's also where you can find the current edition of the Planetary Radio t-shirt, which will also be yours, Mel. So congratulations on that. The rest of you can go take a look for it there. Or you can enter the next contest that Bruce is going to pose for us, because we're going to have the same prizes again.
As a reminder, almost 100 years before Uranus' discovery, John Flamsteed observed it at least 6 times. Here's your question. What name did John Flamsteed give Uranus when he observed it? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You have until the 22nd. That's Wednesday, January 22nd at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. I hope it was Flim Flam. I think that would have been a great name for a planet.
Man, now I need a new question again. No, a little hint, he did not try to name it after a monarch like Herschel did, trying to name it after King George III. I still think it'd be funny if we had a planet named George.
All right. Well, I'm sticking with Flim Flam. I think we're done.
As far as I'm concerned, it is now Uranus is now known as Flim Flam. Then we won't have those other off-color jokes that always happen.
Yep.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about the humor in your everyday life. Thank you and good night.
Well, you know where I get a good piece of it. At least once every week, it's here with the Chief Scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts. And he joins me every week here for What's Up, Doc? Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who can't wait to see more of our solar system and the universe explored. I bet you feel the same way. Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan at Astro.